All right, we'll now take questions or comments on what Howard has had to say.
What do you think of the concept of a just war within Christianity? I think medieval Catholic philosophers and the popes promoted that, and we see that in the Crusades behaviorally. And Islam, you have to come to your heart a holy war, when perhaps wars are sometimes justified. Would you have anything to say about that in terms of what you said? And you did cover this.
Indeed. When I say wars are caused by economic rivalries, I mean they're caused by within capitalist society. Now, they were caused by economic rivalries in the past as well, but there were other causes which may not have been attributable in the same way. I said that in the earliest societies, when tribal groups clashed and so on, they often did because of resources. But I sort of hedged it round by saying usually, because I wouldn't want to be categorical that this is the way wars have always been caused. In the Middle Ages, with holy wars, yes, I mean, it's hard to pin down whether the underlying causes were economic, were land grabbing and so on, or whether the religious beliefs of the society were so overwhelming that they themselves could have constituted a sufficient cause. So that may well have been possible. And with modern Islam, modern Islam is sort of, in recent times, has often been compared to medieval Christianity. I'm not sure whether it's a good comparison or not, but the fact of the matter is, in the modern world, if Islamic groups sort of wage wars, they do so with the modern means of waging wars, and the modern means of waging wars are only there because of the need that states have, that governments have, to protect the national capitalist interests. So even if there is what you might call a religious stroke ideological drive behind wars waged by, for example, these people in the Middle East, the ISIL people, Al-Qaeda and so on, they're only able to do that because of the way capitalism itself works and the way it makes weapons available for people to use in order to carry out these wars.
Good time, I think, that we woke up this morning to look at the front page of the newspaper and see that only yesterday the British Parliament has voted for more war. Do you think the circumstances that brought about that vote in Parliament yesterday was to do with the government being scared about some bunch of terrorists coming here throwing bombs up and down Clapham High Street or a few people's heads off? Or do you think it's really more to do with then have you worried about Daesh starting to take territory and capturing oil fields, and it's more to do with maybe the sort of grounds that the first and second Iraq wars took place in certain parts of?
It's a classic case of unintended consequences. Things sort of escalate once wars begin, and you had these this conflict in Syria, which was at least to a certain extent fueled by the Western powers, with a view to sort of getting a foothold there, ousting Russia, and it's given rise to something they didn't expect, and now they're desperately sort of looking for ways to try and resolve it, and arguably it's still part of the idea of gaining influence in that part of the Middle East, and one of the ways of doing that is getting rid of the people who are waging this religious war, but maybe they've given up on that. Maybe they simply want to establish some kind of sort of status quo. But if they don't do something, then a status quo won't be established. Who knows what will be established? They don't know. These things happen sort of regardless of what plans might be. It was said, I noticed listening to a discussion about this on the radio yesterday, and one or two people said quite correctly that they've got, they don't know what the consequences they didn't know what the consequences of what they did before would cause. They don't know what the consequences of what they're doing now will cause. Okay, they're decided to sort of, you know, attack these religious fighters, but who knows what the consequences of that will be? Who knows whether in a month's time there'll be an enormous outcry because for a month, a year's time, as there was for the Iraq war, that, you know, the British government decided to declare war. Who knows?
Yeah, on the unintended consequences, I'll put it wrong, and something came up on my Facebook page. It was just a brief letter in the newspaper, and it went along the lines of, Saudi Arabia, our friend, was funding ISIL, our enemy, and the way Syria once was our enemy is now fighting ISIL, so now they must be our friend. The Kurds, once the Iraqis' enemies, or the Turks' enemies, now they're fighting us. So all these alliances are all breaking up and reforming. So it's total confusion, and it's all, as you say, it's all unintended consequences. And as for the causes of war, I mean, we're always encouraged when we're trying to find solutions is to go to the root of the problem. And as I see it, the cause of war, indeed, the cause of capitalism, rests on a truly egregious case of mistaken identity. I mean, all us human beings, we all share the same ancestors. So therefore, we're all members of one human family. We're culturally conditioned to accept all these spurious identities, these nationalities that have no real existence except in our imaginations. I think socialism and the end of war can only come about when we actually recognise who we really are, our true identity, so therefore we can then go to be true to ourselves as human beings. And of course, if we acknowledge the fact that we are all members of the human family and we want to live in a functional human family, then we must bring according to ability and take according to need. Otherwise, society is not only dysfunctional, it becomes unhygienic. As capitalism is now socially unhygienic.
Yeah, socialism is about economic equality in the end, isn't it?
Yeah. It's about economic democracy. It's about recognising. It's about identifying with your fellow human being as yourself, because we're all made from the same stuff, out of the same mix. We all carry the same genes. We all have the same history, the same future. It's all inextricably linked. Yeah, and I mean, it's dead simple. If socialism, if nobody, you know, the proposition is if nobody works, nobody lives. But if we all work well, everybody lives well. Now, how can you turn that one down?
I have a question right at the back there.
Yeah, but I'm proceeding down that road in a similar vein. I think if you look at all human conflict, whatever label it comes under, or if it's within our own homes or whatever, it all comes from ego attachment and greed and selfishness. And I wonder how many of us can say that none of us are guilty of these things ourselves, and how many of us actually walk our talk. You know, you talked about the Crusades. Well, that was the label under which their anger, their ego was expressed. You talk about capitalism. Well, that's the flavour of the month. Whatever it is, you know, people find mediums to express their anger, which is an ego attachment and a lack of love and a lack of forgiveness. And I applaud the philosophy and intellectual direction of the Socialist Party. And I wish it could happen. But as individuals, I wonder how much all of us do on a daily basis or do not do to perpetuate what we perceive as an unreasonable and unloving status quo. What do we give? Do we open doors for people? Are we kind to people? Do we forgive people? Do we do charitable work or voluntary work? Or alternatively, people may have different opinions on this, I just throw it out there. Clothes that most of us wearing in this room come from sweatshops, which up there says sweatshop, neighbouring, whatever. How do we balance that in our consciences? Some of us buy the Times newspaper, and I'm sure very few of us would have good words to say about Rupert Murdoch. I'm not judging these things, I'm simply asking the question. And it seems to me, whether it's a religious or an economic or a political label, these are all things, vehicles that we use to validate our own dissatisfaction with ourselves and our anger, which comes from an inability to detach our egos and to forgive and to love.
Well, let's hear an answer from up here. I'll run to you, Harry.
The chairman has asked me for an answer. Well said. What I would say is that it's not easy to walk your talk in a society that has institutionalised selfishness and inequality. Not easy because, everyone has to sort of survive in the best way they can, and, sometimes, it may be impossible to, buy clothes that are more expensive than those that you buy at Primark and maybe are made in sweatshops. I wouldn't condemn people for doing that. I try not to do it myself. I'm sure we all would. But I suppose my answer is this, in the kind of society we live in, most of us, I think, sort of do what we can. I don't know whether anybody's got a better answer than that.
That's part of our question. I don't think we do.
Well, there's another.
We don't do the best we can. We're very good at intellectualising, rationalising, and supporting our own behaviours. But, how many little things do we really do for other people on a daily basis, generally?
Okay, Danny.
About the fact we're a product of society. To an extent, that's true. And, each one of us has to decide how much we're actually prepared to walk as opposed to talk. Perhaps not all of us can be Nelson Mandela. He was a product of his society, but through his courage and his love, he changed the barriers and the prisons of his society. You could say the same for Gandhi and various other people. I think we can all do a lot more by forgiving and loving and working on a daily basis. Very few of us in this world, I think, do enough.
Well, there's another potential answer from Danny, possibly.
Right, well, for a start, there's nothing in substance for anything whatsoever to do with self-sacrifice or self-denial. So that's self-fulfillment. Now, these jeans, Primark, 8 quid. Okay? Now, I could go out and I could buy a pair of jeans for 75. Still made in the same sweatshop by the same people. And everywhere you go, everything we buy, you go to the supermarket, it's full of stuff produced by exploited wage labour. So we're not going to get. I'm not going to get in a moral maze over it for this case. Now you talk about us human beings being egotistical. Well, what you find with ego, as I can see, what I can make out, is ego is like the substitute we take on for self-esteem. Now every working person in the world must suffer from. Well, most of us suffer from low self-esteem. So to be a worker is essentially to be a servant, to be humble, to go and live your life for somebody else. Now, therefore, you can't have self-esteem. To have that self-esteem, you'd be in contradiction with what you're doing. So we humbly submit to the status that we find ourselves in if we're born a working class people. Now, the word esteem comes from the verb to estimate. Now, I like to make an estimate of, us human beings in this room today. And we're using capitalism's way of estimating something's value. I mean, we take a couple of commodities. We take a Rolls Royce or a push bike. Now, a Rolls Royce costs more than a push bike because there's more labour embodied in the production of the Rolls Royce than there is in a push bike. So just use that yardstick in assessing us, making an estimate of who we are. Well, I'll talk about me because I know more about me than anybody else in the room. I know for a fact that my mother and father went out into society and worked long enough to make sure that I had a good living, that I had food, clothing, shelter, medicine, education. They went to society and took their part. Now, without that work, I wouldn't be here today. So you can say that work is embodied in me. Now, my parents didn't spring spontaneously out of nature, they're grandparents. And they worked long enough. You can use their imaginations and go right the way back. Throughout our history, even beyond the time we became modern human beings. And every generation of every living thing that's brought us living and breathing here today has had to struggle, overcome, discover, educate, love, nurture, defend, all involving work. Now, you add all that work and try and put a price on it. Well, you can't, can you? We are prices, but we're forced to go and sell ourselves on the labour market. Now, if we were to know that much about ourselves, about that kind of a thing, we wouldn't need it either. I don't have much ego. I don't look down my nose at people. I don't want more than anybody else. I don't judge myself by the more I have, the more I am, the less other people have, the less they are. You know, once you start getting an idea of who you are and how you're made and what you're worth, then ego, you find very, very little ego in the social side. Because we've all got fairly high esteem. So we don't need to have more than anybody else. And we don't feel guilty. I mean, because we didn't choose to be born. We didn't choose anything about ourselves. We didn't choose the nature of the society. We're not responsible for it. What we're trying to do is change.
I think we have different takes on the understanding of the word ego.
Yeah, could it, just a second, did you want to comment on that? No, it's fine. Okay, it was another question from over here. Question or comment?
More comment. Okay. A couple of comments, most of which friend here has covered. I think however much we as a party recognise that workers have to day-to-day compromise in the society that we live in, because we're but wage slaves, we have very little control over the individual basis over our lives. There is one thing that this party has been clear about since 1904, certainly 1914, which is that the one thing we will not accept other workers to do is to spill each other's blood for the bosses. That is the one line this party stood by that no other party can claim to have done.
Thank you. I'm sorry, you wanted to, the chap, oh sorry, can I just, the chap at the back who has talked about egos, you wanted to define it a bit more carefully, did you?
No,
I'm quite happy for you to do that, as long as you can be reasonably brief, that's all.
I sympathise entirely with what my friend here was saying.
Okay.
But my definition of ego detachment would include anger. And there seems to be, whether it's, you can call it righteous anger or misdirected anger, or whatever kind of anger you wish to label it. But anger is a part of an ego. And I don't think it's productive in human solutions.
Okay, thank you. Quinn?
Yes, I can't see this ego thing explaining events like the Somme and Passchendaele. It doesn't make any sense to me. You know, if it's all down to human greed, then why are there so few rich people and so many poor people? And I'm 74. I've lived most of my life in debt. I'm still in debt to the building society, and I'm living on the bank overdraft. Am I, you know, what is it I'm doing wrong? Is it my greed, my ego? It doesn't explain anything.
Okay, any more questions? Very interesting. Yes?
Can I say that I think a certain kind of anger is not a bad thing, provided that it's a controlled anger, it's not an out of control and going and breaking windows because you're objecting to something about what's happening in society, but a certain amount of concern about how society is run and what's happened. If you have any mind at all, I don't see how you can help but be somewhat angry about things that happen.
Yeah.
And providing the anger spurs you towards looking at why things happen and trying to change the way society works, which you cannot do on an individual basis. No amount of being careful about what clothes you buy and what lights you turn off because you're worried about climate change, no amount of individual action in that way is going to abolish the capitalist system and make a world fit for human beings.
Danny, you got a comment or question?
You've got something to be angry about to start. And the depressing greed again. Greed isn't the fundamental part of our human nature. Greed is just a symptom of the kind of society we live in. We live in a society that's dominated by poverty. And the only way that you can insulate yourself, insure yourself against poverty, is to grab as much material goods around you as possible. It's greed is simply the fear of not having enough. And the thing about all people being greedy, the vast majority of us are so unbelievably generous in that we donate our lives every day to the ruling class of this world. We live our lives for other people. If we were really greedy, we wouldn't stand for it. We're unbelievably generous.
Adam, was it? Yes.
I was just going to say, I think the main difference between our position and that of our friend is he sees wars coming about through some sort of change in individual consciousness, but we see wars as coming to an end through a change in the social structure. So you know, that's the fundamental argument. Socialism will be a society in which wars are just not possible. They don't make sense. Our friend is saying into individuals which should change and become more loving and I don't know what. But I mean that's not the way social change is going to come about. It's not the way wars are going to stop.
That's where we disagree, you see, because I think it's the only one.
Just a second. Could you stand up or speak up, because not everybody can hear you.
Sure. When you talk about anger, and I think anger can often be a good motivator. It can provide energy towards action, but I don't think the expression of anger in human history has ever resulted in anything except more violence and more anger. And without flogging a dead horse, we'll go back to Mr. Mandela, who spent 20 years of his life using violence to achieve his aims, and he then spent 30 years in prison where he loved, befriended and held a mirror up to his guards and through various other social consequence changes and achieved more once arms were laid down than through violence and anger.
Okay.
So, I applaud it as a motivator. But if it's used to express a way to change, it's never worked in history.
Thank
Nelson
you.
Mandela wasn't released through an outbreak of love. Nelson Mandela was released because it was in the economic interest of the ruling class in South Africa to do so.
Yeah, that is also true.
Thank you very much.
If you read his book, he spent his time loving and befriending his guards also, and forgiving.
Yes, Adam. We
add about how we can explain. We're not standing for a violent revolution. We're not. I mean, that's the assumption that being angry makes you take violent action isn't necessarily followed. Doesn't follow in our case. We're angry about what capitalism does to us and to other people, but that doesn't mean that we want to have a violent uprising and hang all the capitalists from lampposts. I mean, we think that we can change. We can have a democratic, more or less peaceful change from capitalism into socialism.
That's about revolution. I mean, that's what it is. Revolutions, I mean, the establishment of day derived the difference from revolution, but part of the French Revolution is, I mean, the French establishment of day, they try the tricolour and they identify in a way with the French Revolution of 1789 when there was a settlement of violence. Robespierre and others promoted, and then they themselves the victims of it. But the French ruling class today say that they derive their literature from the French Revolution. It makes you probably not know that famous story about true and lie. Yeah, the chapter of Chinese foreign section was once asked, what do you think of the impact of the French Revolution? Too early to say. I don't want to know that one.
Thank you.
Can I just say, I think the friend at the back knows that we don't stand for violent revolution. I think he knows that, doesn't he? Yeah, okay, yeah. I think the main point you're making is we should practice what we preach. To a certain extent, I think, we try to. What we can't do is behave in this society as we expect people to behave in the kind of society we advocate, because the conditions are so different. I mean, for example, I've sometimes in the past when I've been outside, trying to sell the socialist standard in various different contexts, and I explained to people that we stood for a moneyless society. People say, "Oh, but you're asking for money for the socialist standard." Well, yeah, we are, because we've no choice in the matter. The way this society operates is that we know it costs money to produce it, and therefore we've got to charge for it. And that applies in lots of different instances as well. I mean, we can't give away all our money to people in need, because we'd be in need ourselves then. So there's a limited amount we can do. And I would say, you know, a lot of us do that limited amount, but, you know, there's only so much can be expected when, as I say, we live in a society which is dominated by the ethic of selfishness, inequality, and class division.
Right. Oh, yes, please, one more.
I think it's clear that you can't live under capitalism the way we would all like to live in socialism. You can't pretend this is a world of equality and cooperation and sharing when it clearly isn't. Of course, we would all like, and I'm sure most of us try to act in a fairly sort of cooperative and humane way, whether it's inside the party or in everyday life. The fact is, this is capitalism and it's based on sharing and selfishness and so on. I rather wish that many workers would be a great deal more selfish and a great deal more bloody greedy, rather than allowing the rich to get away with it. And it said on one of those slogans there, was it the richest 85 people in the world have as much wealth as the poorest 3.5 billion or something? Okay. I mean, why the heck? I mean, people ought to be bloody angry about that, and they ought to do something about it. And they ought to be selfish and say, you know, let's get more of this, the wealth of the world, for us, not just for me, but for the workers of the world. So yes, be a bit more selfish, be a bit more greedy, but realise that the way to do that is through socialism. And if anger is one of the things that starts you off being a socialist, then good.
Thank you.
But I'll calm down.
And go without violence. Okay, Danny.
Just briefly, I mean,
one more.
It's worth remembering that the natural industrial resources of this planet are the common heritage of all human beings. Now, that's not the case practiced in capitalism. So, therefore, there's got to be conflict, hasn't there? Yeah. If all these resources are privately owned and fought over, once it becomes the current common heritage of all of us, then the idea of private property and the idea of the more you have, the more you are, just disappear.
Okay, well, I think we're about wound up, haven't we?
Yeah.
You had a good talk.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all very much. A great discussion, a lively discussion, and thank you, Howard.
Thank you.